One. Oh, that is Sarah.
Hello.
Hello, David. Can you
Hi, how
hear
are
me?
you? I sure can. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Great, good. All right, good to see you.
Your camera, if it could go down a little bit, 'cause it only goes
Yes.
down. There you go. Then we can
There we go.
see your
There
whole
we go.
face.
All right, good. So, how are things in Minnesota?
They're great. The sun came out today. It's very cold.
Oh, really?
Going to be below freezing the next two nights.
You're kidding. And this is April.
I know. Yeah, that's
Well,
Minnesota spring. It can be
that's
80
Minnesota.
degrees or it can snow.
Yeah, I know that from life in Montana, where it can be quite similar.
Oh yeah, right. You
Yeah,
were in
yeah.
Bozeman, right?
I'm in San Francisco now.
No, but you were in Bozeman, yeah?
Yeah, for quite a while, and we still have a house in Bozeman, so we try to spend the summers up there
Nice.
whenever we can, because it's a beautiful place.
Awesome. Well, we're waiting for people to arrive in about
Sure.
5 minutes, but thank you for logging on early. We make sure everything is working.
Sure, of course, and thanks for inviting me.
So you can see the room we're meeting in.
Yeah, it looks very handsome. Looks
There's
very,
about
yeah, it looks great.
30 of us.
And do you meet regularly? I mean, how often do you do this kind of thing?
Yeah, so there's one adult week in the spring this time, and then one in the fall, end of
I see.
September or early October.
And who are most of the people who come? Are they people of German ancestry, or are they Germans themselves, or what?
Some are, but not all. Some are of German ancestry. Some spoke German when they were little kids at home. But in the meantime, not so much and want to improve their German again.
Sure, of
Some
course.
people travel to Germany and like to be able to communicate. Some people have something to do with Germany through their businesses. And for some people, they're just language nerds and they just
Yeah,
like.
well, that's good. That's good.
So yeah, there are a lot of different reasons for coming, and we have about half the people here are veterans who have been here, multiple times, as many as 15 times, and then some are here for the first time. So we always have kind of a mix.
Oh, great. Yeah, it looks like a neat setting, that's for sure. Where in Minnesota exactly is it? It's up in the northern part of the state, is that right?
Yes, it's in northwestern Minnesota. So if you know where Fargo is,
Sure, of
Fargo,
course.
Moorhead, it's a little bit north of maybe 1.5 hours north of north and east of Fargo.
Well, close my door there. Yeah.
Kind of near the Big Red Lake, the Red Lake Indian Reservation, those two giant lakes in the upper left corner.
And do you live there full time, or is that just a place you come to for these meetings, or what?
Yeah, no, we come from all over. I live in Seattle
Oh, really?
and I come to be the program leader. And we have a program leader from Boston, from North Carolina, from Portland. Yeah, so people come from all over the place. We have participants from Arizona, the East Coast. Minnesota, of course. What other places? Oregon, West Virginia.
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 Yeah, really all over there. That's great.
Yeah, people really, I mean, it's an effort to come here, but we feel like it's worth
Yeah,
it.
I bet.
And we have a wonderful chef who makes really good, authentic German food for
Oh,
us.
that's great.
Really, really good. We're s totally spoiled. And we have lots of woods to go hiking in, and there's other camps nearby that we sometimes go visit. So there are eight sites around one lake, and they're all complete camps, and they have mostly young people in the summer. Balse can sleep around 140 people in the summer.
Wow.
So yeah, when it's mostly young people. There's French, Spanish, German, Norwegian,
Whoa.
Swedish and Finnish, Russian and Korean.
Man, that's impressive. That
Yeah,
really is.
so
Yeah.
yeah, the newest site is actually the Korean village. It's like I call it the palace. So some Korean billionaire just donated to build a beautiful state-of-the-art living and language facility.
I'll have to tell my daughter is studying Korean and wants to go to Korea, so I'll have to tell her about that.
Yeah.
She's really caught up in the whole Korean culture.
Well, tell her that they would love to get to know her and maybe have her
I
come and
will.
be
I
part of the
will.
staff.
I will. Yeah, she's very keen on Korea, but right now she's getting ready to apply to law school, so it'll probably be a while before she can, do
All
that.
right.
Yeah, and Seattle, I was a UW graduate, so I lived in Seattle for a while.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I graduated from way back in what, 1967, I think it was that I graduated
Okay.
from UW. Yeah, I loved it.
UW stands.
Nope. Yeah, people around here think UW stands for Madison.
Well, of course they do. Yeah, absolutely. Of course they would. Yeah, my sister went to Madison, so there's a Wisconsin connection too.
Awesome.
And I spent the first 2 years of my life in Rochester, Minnesota.
Okay.
I have some Minnesota. My father was I'll say more about that later, but
Yeah. So I think we'll get us formally started here. I'm going to do a brief introduction for the group. David Clay Large is a historian and author specializing in modern European history with a particular focus on Germany and the Olympic Games. He's currently a professor at the Fromm Institute at the University of San Francisco and a senior fellow at the Institute of European Studies at UC Berkeley. He's taught at Berkeley, Smith College, Montana State in Bozeman, and Yale. His work spans political history, cultural history, and the intersection of sport and politics. Some of his books are Nazi Games, the Olympics of 1936, which is an exploration of the devious mixture of sports and politics surrounding the 36 Berlin Olympics, and how they were used by Nazi propaganda under Goebbels to promote the Third Reich. And then his book on Berlin, A Definitive History of the City, framed by the two German unifications of 1871 and 1990, tracing Berlin's role as a center of modernity, injustice, Cold War tension, and renewed hope. And then he also wrote on the Munich 1972 Games, the first comprehensive history of the Munich Olympic Games, of course, notorious for the abduction of the Israeli athletes by Palestinian terrorists and their tragic deaths. His most recent book on the cultural history of spa towns is The Grand Spas of Central Europe, a history of intrigue, politics, art, and healing. After our interview, there will be time for questions from the group, and feel free to come up close to the microphone and ask your question. Guten Tag, Herr Professor Dr. Large. I want people to hear a proper German introduction.
Okay.
Warm greetings from Waldsee. This is the German village of Concordia Language Villages, where the Adult Week takes place twice a year. Our theme this year is Fußball und Sport in der deutschen Kultur. There are about 30 of us here, and we are very much looking forward to our conversation. So, my first question is, where are you today? Where are we
Also,
speaking to you from?
erst einmal vielen Dank für die Einladung. Das ist wirklich herrlich. Ich bin sehr froh, mitzuteilen. Ich bin in San, I'll speak English. I'm in San Francisco, right in the middle of the city, near Dolores Park, if any of you know San Francisco. But as I was previously telling David, I spend summers whenever I can up in Bozeman, Montana, where my wife and I still have a house. And I grew up basically in Montana, with the exception of the first 2 years in Minnesota. So living in San Francisco, David asked me to say something about my parents. My father came from English stock, but my mother, whose maiden name was Altman, was of Austro-Hungarian ancestry. My dad was an eye surgeon by profession, and it was for that reason that I spent time in Minnesota, because he was on the faculty of the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. However, he always wanted to combine practicing medicine with being some kind of gentleman rancher. So in 1947, the family, my two siblings and I and my parents, moved to Montana, where my father set up a practice in Billings, Montana, but shortly thereafter also bought a former working ranch near Red Lodge, Montana, at the foot of the Beartooth Mountains. I don't know if any of you know that region. It's just absolutely stunning, beautiful. So, I loved growing up in Montana. This working ranch was large enough that each of the children had his or her own house. So from age six, I lived in my own house in the summers. That was the only disadvantage, was to get to the out. I didn't have a toilet in my house, and to get to the outhouse, I had to go by an incinerator during the night, where the bears, we had bears on the property who congregated. So I had to kind of wend my way through these black bears. They weren't grizzly bears, and they didn't harm me, but it still was a bit of an adventure. I grew up there. We had pigs and horses and poultry and goats. I myself raised not pigs, but I had poultry. I had two goats. I had rabbits, and I had a vegetable garden, all of my own. And so I think from that, I really learned a lot of some self-reliance. I had to cook my own meals and so forth and so on, and a love of nature from my mother. Who was very bookish, I got a love of books and a real keen interest in the world outside of Montana. Her father, Isidore Altman, was very instrumental in bringing Hungarian and Austrian Jews to the U.S. during the Holocaust. And I think it was my knowledge of that, what he had done, that encouraged me later on to write a book about the efforts of a single German Jewish family to try to get to the U.S. During the Holocaust. That they failed in that enterprise, but it was a fascinating experience for me to do this work. The book ended up being called "While the World Closed Its Doors: One Family's Effort to Escape the Holocaust." And the German edition is, I have to look here again, it's called "Einwanderung abgelehnt, wie eine deutsche Familie besuchte den Nazis zu entkommen." I think it's the book I'm proudest of, because I got a lot of attention. I got a lot of thankful letters from people who'd been caught up in the Holocaust and so forth, and later got involved in doing a Stolperstein. Stolperstein, everybody
Yeah, in
knows that.
Berlin, yeah.
Yeah, well, not just Berlin. This
Not just Berlin.
little town in Flörsheim near Frankfurt is where the family came from, and so they had a Stolperstein laying there, and I went to participate in that and gave a talk about the history of this little town during the Holocaust. So that was a lot of fun. So I think the upbringing in with a mother who was, very much caught up in the whole German Jewish, Austrian Jewish experience, and my father, who also spoke German, he learned it because in those days when he studied medicine, you really had to know German. And his father, my grandfather, studied medicine at the University of Vienna with Freud. We even have some letters between Freud and my father. I don't know if you realize this, but one thing Freud did was before he got into psychoanalysis and so forth, he worked on ways to provide local anesthetics for eye operations, and for that he used cocaine. No, really, I mean, he became a cocaine addict himself, by the way, Freud did. And my father then, I like to say, brought cocaine to Cleveland, where he then, my grandfather, I mean, where he set up a hospital in Cleveland, his own hospital, and among other things, prescribed cocaine to people. So, that kind of thing. As for Germany and the German language, well, we didn't speak German at home. We could have, but we just didn't. I first started formally studying German in college. I mean, I'm sorry, in high school, and then I went to a gymnasium in Vienna under the AFS program, where I really had to learn a lot of German. That was sink or swim. And then I continued studying German in college. My sophomore year of college, I went back to Vienna again, this time to the University of Vienna, where I had great instructors, people like Hugo Hansch and Walter Leisch, who very, very influential for me. And it was from these people that I really developed the idea that I could become an historian myself, and especially one who focused on Central Europe, and Europe more broadly. But that influence was just absolutely crucial. Had I not done that, had I not gone back to Europe as a young kid, I was what, 16 and 19, I think my life would have been very, very, very different. So I'm very thankful for that experience. And I've kept up going back to Central Europe pretty much every year since then. At Berkeley, I was the co-director of the Austrian Studies program, so a lot of time in Vienna and other parts of Austria. I wrote my dissertation on right-wing paramilitary organizations operating out of Western Austria and Bavaria. So my first book that got published came out of that dissertation research on the Bavarian Einwohner there, right? So again, lots of contact with that part of the world, thanks though to the just luck that I had as a kid, to be sent there and to experience that world.
Yeah, it's not a typical story for a kid growing up on a ranch in Montana.
Right, exactly. No, I really was very fortunate, and I'm thankful to this day that I've had that experience, and I'm able to keep it up. I as I say, I pretty much go back every year. My wife also loves Austria and Germany. We spent a whole year in Munich together, out of which another book of mine came on Munich's Road to the Third Reich. I think the German title is Aufstieg und no Hitler's München Aufstieg und Fall der Hauptstadt der Bewegung. So just and then I wrote another book about the foundation, the political foundation of the Bundeswehr, because I had a year attached
Oh,
to
yeah.
the Militärgeschichtliches Forschungsamt in Freiburg, and so I wrote this book on the rearmament of West Germany in the Adenauer era, and then another one on domestic opposition to Hitler, where I worked with Willy Brandt. That was a lot of fun. It's called Contending with Hitler: Varieties of German Resistance to the Third Reich. So, a lot of writing and a lot of traveling in Central Europe.
All right. Well, our theme, as I said, is the role of sport in German history and how it came to be the way it is, and how it connects with our everybody's conception of what the Olympic Games are. They weren't always the spectacle that they now are.
Oh, that's for
So
sure.
tell us about the role and place of German athletic officials in the early years of the modern Olympic movement. So from, let's say, 1896 to the early 1930s.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. First, I think to put that into perspective, you have to consider the place of the German Reich politically, geopolitically, in that period, the late 19th century, early 20th, a time when there was a lot of hostility toward Germany from the founding major kind of founding partners of the Olympics, namely France, and Great Britain. I mean, of course, you had the legacy still of the Franco-Prussian War, which was especially profound in France, with the loss of Alsace-Lorraine and that sort of thing. And with Britain, you had the fact that Germans tended to favor the Boers in the Boer War in 1900. And then, of course, this famous Anglo-German naval rivalry, right? Really an intense rivalry to build huge battleships and all the rest of it, which led the Western powers into the Entente, the double Entente of the early 20th century. So that's the background in which you have to think of how Germany fit into the Olympic ideal. The founder of the Olympic Games, Baron Coubertin, was no friend of Germany. He personally, he would have liked to keep Germany out of the games entirely, but he realized that a country so powerful and important as Germany couldn't be left out without undermining his whole project. He did keep them out of the organizing meetings for the Olympics, but he didn't keep them out of the 1896 inaugural Olympics in Athens. But it's really, if you look back at the history of those games, and particularly the German role in it, you see that the Germans really didn't really do very well. They their major sport was Turnen, and they had the Turnengesellschaft. So for them, that was not really compatible with the Olympic ideals. The Olympics emphasize individual accomplishment primarily, right? In track and field and so forth. They're team sports, but it's really, especially early on, was primarily individual accomplishment. And that's not what the Turnen experience was all about. It was all about a kind of almost Völkisch Gemeinschaft idea, right? And so the Germans had very little experience with the kinds of sports, track and field, swimming, rowing, and so forth, that were featured in the Olympics. So they didn't do very well, and it was a German gymnast who was the only athlete to be booed at the Athens 1896 games, and of course they finished very low in the standings. So that was not really a very promising beginning for the Germans, and it was even worse in 1900 when the second summer festival was held in Paris, right? And the French certainly were quite aware of the rivalry with Germany. So when the German team arrived, no one was there to meet them. When they came to Paris, they had to walk across the city to find their lodgings, which were really crummy. They saw signs along the way that said things like "cochon," "à bas la Prusse," "pigs, down with Prussia." And the captain of the German team, Fritz Hoffmann, found a pile of human excrement in his bed when he got to his lodging. So, nor were the teams informed about when they were supposed to compete and where and so on. So it was just a real mess for Germany in that experience. And they came out of that pretty embittered. A little better. The next games, sir, most of were held in St. Louis, Missouri, in 1904, held in conjunction with the Lewis and Clark Centennial World's Fair.
World's Fair, yeah.
But St. Louis was a long way from Germany. They couldn't bring a very big team. It was just too expensive. They did pretty well considering they didn't have a very large Mannschaft, But they were totally swamped by the Americans, who had this huge team, and who completely dominated those games. And then, in the London Games of 1908, again held in conjunction with a World's Fair, it was the Americans and the Brits who were absolutely dominant. The Germans really didn't do all that well. The first games in which they did do pretty well was the Stockholm Games of 1912, where I think they won. I think they won something like 7 or 8 medals. I'm not sure the exact number, but they were frustrated. They complained about the fact that the Americans were fielding athletes who were Black or Native American, and the most famous athlete of those games was a Native American named Jim Thorpe. Who totally dominated in track and field. Sadly, his medals were later taken away from him because he was accused of having participated in semi-pro baseball. It was a total tragedy, really. But anyway, so you have this rather not terribly pleasant or a successful experience for the Germans in those early games, and then. In 1916, the games were supposed to be in Berlin. Finally, the Germans would get to host the games, but there was another game going on at the same time, namely the First World War, which took priority. The games are supposed to be above politics and spared from politics. There, in the ancient games, there was something called the Olympic truce, whereby people were supposed to stop fighting, during the games, and so the games could go on. But boy, the fighting was really fierce in 1916. That was the time of the Somme, and so the games were canceled. Berlin had gone to the trouble of building a special stadium, and everybody was all excited, in 1914 or so about hosting these games, but it just didn't happen. And because of all the animosity toward Germany resulting from the war, Germans were excluded entirely from the Antwerp Games of 1920, and then the Paris Games in 1924. No Germans at all. No Turks either. No Austrians. And Central Powers were excluded. It wasn't until Amsterdam in 1928 that the Germans got back into the game, and they did pretty well at Amsterdam. But there remained a lot of ambivalence in Germany about this whole Olympic experience. I mean, it really wasn't their thing as it was for the French and above all for the Americans and the Brits. The Americans, in particular, just dominated the early Olympics, with the exception of 1908, where the Brits came out on top. So let me pause there and ask if there are any more questions about that, about
Any
those.
questions about that time before we begin to talk about the Nazi regime? Thank you very much for that brief review of all the game and the Germans' experience of them. That is amazing.
It's again, I think had the Germans been more successful, perhaps there wouldn't have been so much frustration down the line. But they, as I said, they didn't get back in until 1928, and then Hitler was already, of course, well on the rise. The Nazis, having started in Munich in the early 20s, were starting in 28, 1930, 32, they were really on the rise, and so one had to wonder what they thought about these games, and it was quite negative. I mean, if most Germans were somewhat ambivalent about the games, the Nazi movement was absolutely opposed to the Olympics. They hated the ideal of peaceful competition among all nations, regardless of. Of race or religion or whatever that's part of, it was enshrined in the ideals of the games. What the Nazis liked was Wehrsport, I mean military sports that oriented toward the military. Boxing would be included in that. Hitler liked boxing, but otherwise they thought the Olympics were an abomination. Hitler himself, I think it was in 1923 or something, said that the Olympic, the modern Olympic movement was a conspiracy of Jews and Freemasons, right? Jews and Freemasons. And then in 1932, when the Germans did participate, they had a pretty bad experience in Los Angeles, where they had to compete with a lot of African Americans. Now, there's some African Americans already, even before 36, before Jesse Owens in the sport, and they really didn't do well at all in 32, and that just hardened the Hitler movement against the Olympics. Now, the Berlin Games were awarded to that city in 1931. So before Hitler came to power, that was, remember, in January 33. So the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, thought Berlin would be a good candidate because they wanted to support the Weimar Republic, right, which was really struggling at that point in the early 30s. And the hope was that hosting the games would really help this Weimar Republic stay alive. Berlin's main competitor was Rome, and Rome was under fascist dictatorship. And the IOC said, we don't want to give the games to a fascist dictatorship. So there's a huge irony here. Hitler
Yeah.
comes to power in 33, and then the question for the IOC was, what do we do? Do we move the games? What do we do? And now the ball was, to a large degree, in Hitler's court. Hitler had to decide, well, do we want to keep the games or not? And there was some opposition within the Nazi movement to having the games at all. But Hitler, who himself had opposed the Olympics earlier on, talked to Goebbels, and he talked to the main organizer, a man named Theodor Lewald, and another man named Karl Diem, who convinced him of several things. First, the games could be a financial windfall, they said, for Berlin and Germany. Remember, this was depression now. Germany was really hurting. Germany was harder hit by the depression than any other European country because it was so dependent on American financing and American money. So hard currency was something that the regime really wanted. Unemployment was very high, and there was a thought, as Goebbels said, well, look, if we host these games, we're going to have to put a lot of people to work. So it'll really help for employment. And Goebbels also said, what about the propaganda? We can use these games to really spread the message and to show the world that we're good guys and that we're we have a great nation and the rest of it. And then finally, the thing that I think really convinced Hitler was the thought that, well, these Olympics will require a huge architectural stage. He loved architecture, as I'm sure most of you know. He loved the thought of building. And so that's really what brought him around. The combination of money, of propaganda value, and then building this great stage. And so
Complex,
he then said he then said to the IOC, okay, we'll do this, we'll take it on, but we want to have our own rules when it comes to whom we allowed to participate.
yeah.
First, the issue was, well, we don't want Jews and blacks coming to Berlin. I mean, I think I have a quotation from, if I could find it, from the Fürsprecher Beobachter about this. I'll just read it in German, if that's okay.
Yeah, klar.
Yeah. Okay. So this was after the 1932 games, in which the German team fared pretty badly, losing contests to blacks, to American blacks, like Eddie Tolan, for example. So the VB said this. I'll read it to you. Neger haben auf der Olympiade nichts zu suchen. So kann man heute leider erleben, dass der freie Mann oft sogar mit Negern um die Siegesplamme kämpfen muss. Das ist eine Schändung und Entwürdigung des olympischen Gedankens ohnegleichen. Und die alten Griechen würden sich bestimmt im Grabe umdrehen, wenn sie wüssten, was moderne Menschen aus ihren heiligen Nationalspielen gemacht haben. Die nächsten Olympischen Spiele finden im Jahr 1936 in Berlin statt. Hoffentlich wissen die verantwortlichen Männer, was ihre Pflicht ist. Die Schwarzen müssen ausgeschlossen werden. Wir erwarten das. So that was the proposition, And the IOC said, you can't do that. You can't decide who goes to the Olympic Games. So after some hemming and hawing, the Germans said, okay, yeah, foreign teams can send whomever they want. They can send Jews, they can send blacks. But we Germans want to make sure that we have control over our own team. We'll decide to make up the makeup of our own squad. And some in the IOC were agreeable to that. I think Avery Brundage was head of the American Olympic Committee at that time, believed that would be okay. But others said, no, that's not on. You can't do that. You have to allow Jews to participate, Jews and any other people to participate in the qualifying events and all the rest of it. Eventually, as some of you may know, the Germans did make a compromise on this score. They admitted a half-Jewish fencer named Helena Mayer to participate in the Summer Games, and a half-Jewish hockey player named Rudi Ball to participate in the Garmisch-Partenkirchen Winter Games. Now, these were cosmetic compromises, especially with Helena Mayer, because she was only half Jewish. Her mother was quote unquote Aryan, and she was a great fencer. She'd won the gold medal, won a gold medal in 32, and the Germans hoped to win medals, and also this Heidi, was a kind of a blonde Valkyrie. She didn't identify as Jewish, and she promised she w wouldn't complain about anything with regard to racism in Germany. So she was put on the team. She eventually won a silver medal, not a gold. But the concessions with Meyer and Ball meant that the boycott effort, which came out of America primarily, did not succeed. It came very close to succeeding. I mean, there was just one vote that separated those from who didn't want America to go to the games, and those like Avery Brundage who did. So of course the Americans famously sent this big team with people like Jesse Owens, to participate in Berlin. But it took a lot of finagling, and the Germans ended up having to bend over backwards to keep the games in Berlin. Any questions about that before we go on?
So I have a question.
Sure,
Oh,
sure,
yeah, we do have one question here.
sure. Sure, please.
Do you think it was a mistake to let Germany have the Olympics in Germany in 36?
Yes, and I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. I'm not in favor generally of boycotts. I think often, most often, they really don't work. But in this case, I think if the U.S. had boycotted, well, first, if the U.S. had boycotted, it's pretty clear that France and Britain would have gone out too. And that would have really ruined Hitler's games. And they were very important to Hitler, not so much for foreign propaganda, as is often argued, but rather to assure Hitler's dominance within Germany. Remember, this is 36. They're only 3 years into the Nazi Reich. The Depression was still going on. The dictatorship was an unfinished project at that point. And Hitler needed a successful coup, an organizational coup, to prove to his people that he could do this kind of thing, that the Nazis could be successful in organizing such a major world event and not embarrass themselves. It was especially important for young people in Germany to get the impression that this movement could handle this kind of event. American diplomats in Berlin told the Roosevelt administration, I think quite rightly, that if America boycotts, it'll really hurt Germany, and that's really what we should do. But Roosevelt did not want to go that route. He did not want to be he, seem to favor the Semites too much, and because he was already being accused of having too many Jews in his administration. And so the decision was made to go. But yes, I think it. I'm not saying it would have brought Hitler down, but it certainly would have been a major blow to the regime at a time when they really needed a boost, right? So it's. I don't think the Americans should have boycotted Moscow in 1980, but I think we should have boycotted Berlin in 1936 for those reasons.
Okay. So I'm a long distance cross country skier. So I'm also interested in the winter games, of course. So there's not much known or remembered about the winter games in Garmisch-Partenkirchen. And why should that earlier Olympic Games be remembered along with the Berlin Summer Games?
Well, first, let me say that the Garmisch Games, the Winter Games, were awarded to Germany after Hitler came to power in 1934, which in itself is quite interesting. But why were they so important? Well, they were a rehearsal for Berlin. The Germans had never put on, I mean, the Nazis had never put on a big a spectacle of that kind, and so they needed to work on issues like security, crowd control, hospitality, all that kind of thing. They needed a kind of not quite dry run, but they needed a practice run in a sense, and that's what the Garmisch Games provided for the Germans. It was a very important lesson for them that they could apply later on to Berlin. The other thing that's very important to remember is that once the Garmisch Games got going and all the countries who wanted to participate did so, that killed off the boycott for Berlin. Once Garmisch had happened, there was almost no chance that Berlin would be boycotted. And these games had to come off in spite of huge anti-Semitism in Bavaria. I mean, there was anti-Semitism across Nazi Germany, of course, but nowhere stronger than in the Bavarian Alps. After all, just over the hill, you had Oberammergau, or the Passion, those Passionsspiele took place every once in a while, which were hugely anti-Semitic. And so when Garmisch began to prepare for the games, local leaders made clear to Hitler and so forth that they wanted to preserve all their particular their anti-Semitic ideals. They had signs all over town saying Jews are unwanted. They had traffic signs on the roads that gave speed limits on dangerous curves with a smaller sign below that said, "But Jews are accepted from this." In other words, Jews can travel as fast as they want and kill themselves. It got so bad that the head of the IOC, Balai Latour, made a study visit to Garmisch and found all of this anti-Semitism going on. And he basically said, to Hitler, if you don't get rid of this stuff, we're gonna cancel this. So Hitler himself now gave orders to get those signs off of there, gave orders to restaurateurs and hotel owners and so forth. You cannot discriminate on the basis of race. You can't exclude Jewish-looking people as they wanted to do. And Himmler himself said that if anyone is caught practicing open anti-Semitism in Garmisch, I'll put them in a concentration camp. That's really odd when you have Himmler threatening a concentration camp for anti-Semitism, right? But it was a big thing. Garmisch had to come off peacefully and successfully if Berlin wasn't going to be threatened. And it did work out for the Germans. I mean, the games were well organized. They had plenty of snow. First, it didn't look like they would have, but they in the end did. So it was successfully run. There was one problem when the IOC ruled that the Austrian and Swiss Alpine skiers couldn't participate because they were professionals. They were ski teachers and so forth and so on. And so the whole Swiss and Austrian Alpine teams, all the teams boycotted those games. And that allowed the Germans to do pretty well in skiing when they probably wouldn't have had to compete with the Austrians and the Swiss. But those games came off well. And the other thing is that the German government used these games to disguise, to camouflage the fact that they were just about to remilitarize the Rhineland. They wanted the French to be kind of duped. So the French go to Garmisch and are much welcomed and heralded and all the rest of it. Just a month later, the Germans march into the Rhineland. So it had that kind of political focus to it as well. But those games are really very important, and a lot of people don't even realize that there were winter games in Germany, as well as, of course, the famous, more famous summer games in Berlin.
So today, when we attend the Olympics or watch the Olympics, we're used to this gigantic spectacle with the opening ceremony, the closing ceremony, and all of that. Before the 36 games, the scale was much smaller. I mean, in the beginning, they were just small attachments attached to the World's Fair, which was the big
That's right.
event.
That's right.
So, how did the Berlin games shape the games in general? And is it really the Berlin games that started this sense of the games as this enormous media and cultural spectacle?
Speaking of media spectacle, you know, the Berlin Games were the largest media spectacle to date in history, up to that point. I mean, with radio and, of course, very primitive television, it was a huge media spectacle. But it was a spectacle in lots of other ways. A lot of people don't realize that it was the Germans who invented the torch relay and brought it into the Olympics. There had been no torch relays before, and there were no torch relays in the ancient games either. But Carl Diem, in particular, came up with the idea that the torch relay could, on the one hand, really effectively advertise the games. You know, it would be held before the games went on, and so it would call attention to the games. And then ideologically and politically, it would suggest a strong connection between Nazi Germany and ancient Olympia, ancient Greece. So the claim of the part of the Germans was that they're the best stewards. The Nazis were the best stewards of the ancient Olympic ideal, and how better to promote that idea than to have this torch relay, which starts in with the lighting of a flame in ancient Olympia and goes all across southeastern Europe and so to Berlin. So that's what got that whole thing going. Leni Riefenstahl, who made the famous film based on the Olympics called Olympia, filmed part of the torch relay. She had a role in organizing it too, by the way. And it was a success. I mean, people were amazed by it. This torch going all the way across to Berlin, and then being, you know, lit, it would light this cauldron in the stadium itself. So that was a huge innovation, and we live with it to this day, right? There's now torch relays for every Olympics. I'm not a fan of the torch relay, by the way. I think it's kind of kitschy, but it
I'm
really
not now.
was
I
that what?
am not a fan now.
Yeah, I'm not a fan either, but nobody asked me. You know, no. I mean, it was successful as a promotional stunt. There are other innovations too. I mean, the games had never been advertised much before, but the Germans, for domestic purposes, had this so-called Olympischer Zug, this train. It was actually a bunch of trucks that went all around the country advertising the games, had mock-ups of the stadium and all the rest of it. They had a Zeppelin advertising the games that flew over South America. I mean, they really went all out to advertise these things, and that was unprecedented. So in that sense, a great deal of innovation. When it comes to the infrastructure for the games themselves, now LA had pioneered this huge stadium, and I mean the LA Coliseum, right? The Germans did not want to be outdone by that, so they built a stadium about the same size. Hitler wanted a bigger one, but eventually it ended up being maybe a little bit larger than LA, but not much. The main thing about the stadium, aside from its size, was that it was Greek. I mean, it was Ionic. I mean, Doric in composition and style. Hitler brought in Albert Speer to help with the design. The original architect was Werner Marsch, but Speer came in to help with all the columns and all the rest of it. And then the rest of the so-called Reich Sportfeld contained all sorts of nods to ancient Greece. There was the open-air theater that was designed to look like the old Greek theaters. The whole thing was meant to suggest that, again, Berlin or Nazi Berlin is the real steward of ancient Olympia. The stadium was surrounded with a statuary representing ancient Greek athletes, like the discus thrower and so forth and so on. And these were all designed and put together by leading Nazi German artists. So there was innovation along those lines. There was also innovation in security. There hadn't been a lot of security for the games in earlier times, but Hitler knew, everybody knew that there was animosity toward Nazi Germany, and that they would have to be very careful. So Hitler had his own special Führerschutz at the games. Whenever he traveled in a convoy of several Mercedes Benzes to disguise exactly where he was. In the stadium where he announced the opening of the games and where he sat, there was a shield, a bulletproof shield. It didn't go all the way up to his head, but it was there. There were uniformed and plainclothes policemen all over the place. They searched for bombs. They had dogs. It was a major effort in security that had never happened before. But it set an example for later games. Security would become one of the most expensive items in Olympic hosting. Munich, of course, would add to that even more. Munich 72, and then you had the huge bombastic opening and closing ceremonies too. That had been rather low key before, but the Germans took out all the stops when it came to the march in. They had the Olympic Orchestra, this huge orchestra that played an Olympic hymn written by Richard Strauss and directed by Richard Strauss. They had people from the Bayreuth Orchestra coming and participating in this. Bayreuth normally occurs just one time in the summer, but in order not to have it overlap with the Olympics, they divided it in 36 into two parts so that the Bayreuth people could come, the chorus from Bayreuth could come and participate in the musical events surrounding the Berlin Games. So an enormous outlay. The cost too is another thing. We don't know exactly how much the Reich spent. They didn't keep very accurate records, but it was astounding. We know that, and it was a loss. I mean, they didn't make money from these games. At least the organizers didn't make money. Some of the vendors did. And speaking of vendors, the Nazis were big on having these exclusive food items and beverages for the games. They had a special beer for Berlin, but they also spent a lot of money for Coca-Cola. Robert Woodruff, the head of Coca-Cola, came to Berlin to try to get Coke to be the primary exclusive beverage for Berlin. He didn't get that, but he got the right to put up Coke stands all around the games, and not in the stadium, but all around. And so that was another big step forward. And Adidas, the shoemaker, too, got on board and provided free shoes to people like Jesse Owens. He ran with Adidas shoes.
Yeah, I think custom-made shoes, I
Ab
think.
absolutely, absolutely. Not Nike. I mean, Nike came much later.
And
So, yeah, and Puma, of course. Adidas and Puma split into two companies. They were originally one, a Bavarian company. So, in all of these ways, you have really precedent-setting examples from Berlin, for good and for not so good, in my opinion.
awesome. So, I have a question. Since
Sure.
we've been thinking about this sport in German culture and we've learned a bit about the Turnenbewegung,
Right.
how did the Berlin Olympics, transform that or help transform that earlier culture of Turnen into the culture today of what we would call Leistungssport? So
Sure.
nicht Breitensport, sondern
Yeah.
Leistungssport and the
Genau.
professionalism in sport that we see today.
Sure. Of course, I think you all know that professionals were not allowed in 36, at
At
least
that time.
officially. There were some who were really kind of session. But no, the Tournan originally was a collective idea. It wasn't a sport in which individuals stood out. The whole idea was supposed to be a collective, but that changed through the Olympics because the Olympic competitions, they did have some team events, of course, in gymnastics, but almost all of it was individual, right? And that meant elite, an elite individual performance was what counted. And the Germans themselves developed that by 36. They had this guy Schwarzbad, who was a great a gymnast, who did very very well. And they learned to make adjustments along those lines quite successfully, I would say, over the years. Professionalism didn't really come about until much later, not officially, in fact, until 1992, the Barcelona Games. But the Germans certainly developed this idea of cultivating individual sporting stars, and they had in 36 they had a guy named Breitmeier, who was a very good runner. They had Lutz Long, who was a jumper, a broad jumper, who competed against Owens, and famously afterwards, walked arm in arm with Owens around the field, which was really staggering for a lot of Germans to see a black man and this white guy walk around together.
And if I'm not mistaken, they became lifelong
They
friends.
did. They did. Absolutely. They corresponded with each other. Jesse Owens kept up with the family, and when Long was killed later in World War II, he sent sympathy notes and so on to the family and all the rest of it. Yeah, they became lifelong friends. Absolutely. Yeah. So the Olympics really changed the way Germans looked at sport. No question about it. They got on the bandwagon with other countries like America and Britain, who for a long time had already, emphasized individual sporting accomplishment.
So we have a bit of time left. Tell us a bit about the 1972
Yeah.
Olympics. It's the
Yeah.
second Olympics
Right.
held, awarded to Germany and held there in Munich. And it
Right.
wasn't an easy road either. What kind of obstacles had to be overcome for that to happen?
Yeah, of course. Munich, the secret capital of Germany, it was called because Berlin was divided and Bonn was so unprepossessing. The Germans wanted to get the games back to show off their new cosmopolitan, transparently democratic culture and so forth. But Munich was a tough choice because, after all, as we all know, it was the Hauptstadt der Bewegung. It was the place where the Nazi movement was born. It was the site of the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923 when Hitler tried to take power. It was the site of the Entartete Kunst exhibit, the opening of the Entartete Kunst. It was the site of the famous, infamous Munich conference, whereby Czechoslovakia was sold down the line. It had a lot of baggage, right, in the past, and so a lot of people say, "Well, we can't have the games in a place like that." But it also had problems in the present, which presented obstacles, especially to the east, to the Eastern powers, those in the Soviet bloc. Munich, after the Second World War, was really overrun by refugees from the Soviet bloc, Vertriebene, and Czechs and Poles and so forth and so on, who flooded into Munich. So it became a kind of a hotbed of virulent anti-communism. It was also the headquarters of Radio Free Europe, and Radio Liberty. Pulak, a suburb, was the headquarters of the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German spy agency. So in the eyes of the Easterners, it was an impossible place. I mean, God, talk about a political hotbed of anti-communism. That's Munich. So they had to, the organizers had to overcome all of this. They had to promise the Easterners, including the DDR, the East Germans, that there wouldn't be any hostility shown to them, that they'd be treated fine, and all the rest of it. It was especially important for the GDR, because the Eastern Germans had not really participated much in the Olympics until that time. I mean, they were kept out. There were no Eastern or Westerns, for that matter, until Oslo 52, and then it was just West Germany. When the Germans were reintegrated into the fold, they had to compete as a single team, using the Schiller Ode to Joy as the hymn and that sort of thing, and the Olympic flag. So it wasn't until 72 that the GDR got to participate as a sovereign nation with its own symbols. That was the first time that happened, and that's what brought the GDR around to the idea that they should participate, because they wanted to win. They had a strong program by that time. We all know that they really seriously trained their athletes, and we also know famously about the doping. It was said about the East German team, where men are men and so are the women, because of all these steroids that they were taking. The USSR wanted to participate eventually, because it would be the 50th anniversary of the foundation of the Soviet Union in 1922. They wanted to win 50 medals, 50 gold medals actually. And the GDR wanted to show up the West Germans, which they managed to do pretty much in Munich. But what we really remember about Munich, unfortunately, primarily, is the Palestinian attack, the September attacks that led to the murder of 11 Israelis, and this just terrible debacle that transpired first in the village and then in Fürstenfeldbruck, where the rest of the surviving hostages were killed, largely because of ineptness due to the German organizers. They certainly weren't prepared to deal with this challenge. They didn't have a counter terrorism operation. They had their security. They did have security, but it was meant to be light. It was meant to not re remind people of the heavy security of the Third Reich. So they didn't have
Oh.
barbed. They didn't have barbed wire around the village. They didn't have uniformed guards with guns. They had these oldies who were dressed like seniors from Cleveland or something, untrained in matters military. The irony, the terrible irony, is that in trying not to look at all like Berlin 36, they ended up having Jews killed on German soil again, not by the Germans themselves, but still partly out of German ineptitude. And that's the real tragedy of Munich 72, because otherwise it was beautifully run. In fact, it was supposed to be called, it was called the Olympics of Joy, the Heiterenspiele, right? And so they had this thing called the Spielstraße, which was an alley of interactive games and festivities and puppets and so forth and so on. They had lots of really great entertainment. The opening ceremony was very different than Berlin. It was the songs were all meant to appeal to the particular teams that were entering. They had a balalaika for the Russians. They had a samba for the Brazilians and so on. I mean, it was really something, beautifully organized in that regard, but then blighted terribly by this tragedy, which is what we think about still today, primarily when we think about Munich.
So, if I'm not mistaken, there were some at the time who wanted to just stop the games when the
Absolutely.
terror attack happened. And then there are others who said, no, we need to not let the terrorists win. We need to
Sure.
finish and carry on to the games as planned. So
Sure.
tell us about that.
Yeah, of course, Israel in particular wanted the game stopped, and indeed, Israel withdrew its delegation from Munich after the massacre. There were others. I mean, in the United States, there were many people who spoke out that the games should be canceled. The rest of the games should be canceled. There were even some Germans who wanted that, but the organizers certainly didn't cancel it, nor did Avery Brundage. At that point, he was the president of the IOC. It was his last Olympics as president of the IOC. He really wanted the games to continue, and so did German television, which they didn't have any programming set up for
Replace it, yeah.
to replace the games. And so famously, the decision was made after a day or so of absence, and they had a memorial, for the slain athletes and one West German policeman. The games must go on, said Avery Brundage, and this caused a lot of consternation. The LA Times ran an editorial saying it was like dancing at Dachau, that they would do this. Most of the athletes, however, wanted to continue. Obviously, they want to they want to show their stuff. And so the games did go on, but it adds another dimension to the tragedy, to the horror of all of this, that the games should go on, resume so quickly after the massacre, almost as if nothing had happened. I mean, that I think really rubbed the wrong way for quite a few people.
Well, we are so grateful that you have were able to be with us today. And this is an amazing overview of this of our topic. So before we have question and answer, I have a couple questions for you. What are
Sure.
three films or TV shows or podcasts
Okay.
that we should definitely watch or listen to?
Well, there are more than three, but let me. Obviously, the first thing that comes to mind is Olympia. Now, I suppose most of you have seen Leni Riefenstahl's film Olympia. It's long. It's she always claimed that it was. I interviewed her once, by the way, and she said, "Oh, this was an art film. It had nothing to do with the politics. That's not true. There's a lot of politics in it. But I would say watch Olympia because it is a fabulous piece of work. Also for 36, there are. I'll just grab a couple of things here. Let me show you. There are a number of documentaries that I worked on most of these.
Oh, no
Promotion here.
problem. Go ahead. Load away.
There's a there's a NBC documentary called More Than Gold, with narrated by Morgan Freeman, and it's More Than Gold, and the subtitle is Jesse Owens and the 1936 Berlin Olympics. So and again, it's easy to get. It's a DVD, NBC, and I worked on that. Also on another project. Some of you are familiar, I think, with a book called The Boys in the Boat. It's about the University of
Yes.
Washington Husky crew, which won gold. Yes, right.
Yes.
A great story. It was also then made into a DVD, which I helped produce or put on. It's called The Boys of 36. But it's based on, and it's part of the American Experience program on PBS. So you can easily get that. There's another documentary, a PBS documentary, just called The Nazi Games, Berlin 1936. Right? The Nazi Games. All these are, I don't know, there's the Nazi Games, the boys of 36, and More Than Gold. For Munich, there is a wealth of th there's Munich, like Berlin, had a film based on it. The Munich case, it's called Visions of Eight. Eight famous directors were invited to present their take on the Munich Games, what the Munich Games amounted to. So you've got eight world-class directors, including John Schlesinger, for example, who did the one on the marathon. That's really worth seeing. And then, of course, there's the famous Munich, Spielberg's film on the efforts by the Israeli government to track down and kill remaining members of the Black September command that perpetrated the Munich massacre. There's a much more recent film just called September 5. And it's about ABC and John McKay and the whole broadcasting of the Munich Games. So that I would recommend as well. I worked on all of these in one way or another. That's what happens if you write books about something, then you end up doing a lot of film work as well. But it was fun. It was fun.
Awesome. So, by the way, we're going to watch a film on Thursday called Das Wunder von Bern about
Yes,
the
football.
national team
Sure.
in the
Yeah.
World Cup. But
Yeah, sure.
the German translation of Boys in the Boat is Das Wunder von Berlin.
Yeah, there you go.
So
Yeah.
the German translator or publisher wanted to connect it.
Yeah, of course, of course, of course. And it was a wonder. I mean, for these husky, for these guys, these rural guys from, guys from rural Washington, primarily. And when we worked on the film, we did a lot of the old Husky boathouse, which is now a museum. The crew team now has a very fancy boathouse on the campus on Lake Union, but the old boathouse is still there. And so we did some of the filming at that place.
And it's being renovated right now. I row
Yeah.
past it three times
Yeah.
a week.
Yeah. All right. So you know about that. Yeah.
So, if anyone's interested in hearing from me the story of Boys in the Boat, I'll be glad to tell you
Yeah.
anytime.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, my son, when he was in 10th grade, we took 160 juniors from the rowing club to the boathouse because one of those guys was still alive, Shorty
Yeah.
Hunt.
Yeah, yeah,
And
yeah.
we sat in the dining room with the boat hanging from the
That's
ceiling
right. That's right.
there,
Yeah. It's right there. It's still there.
and we got to meet Shorty Hunt before he died. He died about a year
Yeah.
later,
Yeah, they
and
yeah.
our juniors got to spend an hour hearing about the Berlin Olympics.
It's a great story. I mean, there are a lot of wonderful athletic stories coming out of these games. I mean, of course, Jesse Owens and Ole Corbett and the basketball game in Munich, between the Soviets and the United States and all these kinds of things. That's part of the story. But my background is,
And Team Minnesota,
I
the
mean, they're all
Miracle on Ice,
exactly.
1880.
Excellent. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. We just hope that the games coming up in 28 in Los Angeles will be not be a fiasco. We have worries about it given the current political situation in the US and all of that sort of stuff, and we worry about the World Cup coming up even sooner this year. So we'll have to see. But the Olympics are one thing you have to remember: the Olympics are always political. They said at the start they would be above politics. They've never been above politics, not even starting in Athens, nor were the ancient games above politics, by the way. There was politics in those too. So, it's part of life. It's part of life. It can get messy, but it can also be beautiful.
So, who has
Yes.
a question for
Question.
Dr. Barnes?
Yeah, please.
I guess I'll ask the obvious one about Jesse Owens, probably the most renowned track and field athlete from the US before Carl Lewis.
I
How
would
big?
say Jim Thorpe. Don't forget Jim Thorpe.
Well, okay, yeah,
Yeah,
that's
all
true.
right. Yeah. No, go ahead. Go ahead with your
How big a
question.
deal was it both within Germany and outside of Germany for him
It
to do so well?
was huge in both places. I mean, there was much celebration in the US, of course, especially in the black press, though some of the main US papers didn't have much to say about it at all, which is too bad. In Germany, he was celebrated. He wasn't. He didn't face any discrimination. Hitler didn't snub him, by the way. That's a myth. He felt treated very well in Berlin. The trouble is, when he came back, there really wasn't an infrastructure for professional track and field. He ended up participating in sort of kind of lower end crass events like running against Joe Lewis or an automobile or a racehorse. He really had trouble when he came back to the US because there was still tremendous discrimination, of course, against blacks. The professional leagues weren't integrated yet. That wouldn't happen until starting in the 50s. And so he was celebrated for a time. But later on, the problem was that the racism just continued to go along. And it wouldn't be until much later that he would really I think find his true place. The other thing you have to remember is that the Germans and even the Americans found ways to explain his achievements along racist lines. They said, well, blacks are closer to their ape ancestry. You know, they can jump higher. They have certain musculature that allows them to do the things that they do. That gives them certain advantages, but they can never be good at in team sports like basketball, it was said. I'm not kidding. This came out in the U.S. right after 36. There was an article published by a famous physician from Johns Hopkins who about Jesse Owens and about the blacks, who said, you know, yeah, they can run fast and for short distances, but they could never do a long distance race. Look at the Boston Marathon. Who wins that? Right? You know, I mean, and look at basketball. These prejudices that were not undercut tremendously by what Jesse and other blacks did in 36. But Jesse was by no means the only black athlete. The American team won 13, the blacks on the American team won 13 medals, more than any other single team in the game. So it was a huge success for the blacks, but the take-home message for a lot of whites was, oh, they just have this what Goebbels called a jungle inheritance that allows them to participate well in certain kinds of sports, but nothing requiring sophistication, mental acuity, or teamwork like basketball, right? I mean, they actually said that. So the Jesse Owens story is very interesting in that regard. Plus, I should add that Jesse Owens himself never felt discriminated against by Hitler. He admired Hitler. He came back to the U.S. and said Hitler is the man of the hour. He shouldn't have been dissed by the American press, and that it was Roosevelt who had snubbed him because Roosevelt didn't send him a congratulatory telegram. Not Hitler. It's a complicated and rather sad story in many ways.
Thanks again, Professor Large. I've got a question about how sports venues were used for political purposes. And I'm thinking of the Berlin Sportpalast, where there were Nazi rallies, communist rallies, and that wasn't an Olympic venue per se. But I'm wondering if the Olympic venues were used for political purposes as well, or if you could expand on that a little bit.
I mean, the Germans continued to use the stadium and the Dietrich Eckart Theater and so forth for various political rallies, all the way up into the war. They also put it into the basement of the stadium, various small factories for manufacturing armaments. So, you know, there was actually a militarization of that. And the other thing is that the Olympic Village, you know, out there in Döberitz was used as a training base for the Condor Legion that went to fight, you know, in the Spanish Civil War on Franco's side. So as far as Nazi Germany was concerned, yes, those structures, those sporting arenas continued to have high political value. Munich less so for obvious reasons. I mean, first we're talking about a democracy. There were attempts to make positive use out of the Olympic Village, Carnoldystrasse, where the Munich massacre occurred. There was an attempt to turn it into a kind of memory site, but that never really worked out. It now it doesn't really have much of a function anymore at all. But yeah, I mean, those locations have continue to have rev when the Berliners applied to host the 2000 get summer games, they wanted to have them again at the Reichssportfeld, and that was one of the reasons why they couldn't get that award. It went to Sydney instead. These places are haunted in some ways. I mean, I did some filming about a German railroads that took me to the Reichsportfeld, and I just felt haunted by just walking back into that place again. It's of course very different. It's changed around a little bit inside. The exterior is still the same, but yeah, there again, the Olympics and almost all sporting events have some kind of political association. It's a big time here, the international ones. So yeah, I'd say that's very much the case.
Alex, yeah. You can just stand here. You don't have to bend down.
Sorry. Do you believe that do you think that the modern use of the Olympics for propaganda is still taking place? I'm thinking particularly of the Pyeongchang Winter Games, where Kim Jong-un sent some family members.
Oh, sure, they're still used for political purposes. I mean, that's been that was famously Moscow 1980, of course, but also LA 84, you know, was meant to showcase American capitalistic, you know, success and so forth and so on. Yeah, Beijing, you know, has hosted both the winter and the summer games, using those occasions as a way to advertise Chinese prowess and Chinese ideals. So yeah, no, it definitely still goes on. Absolutely.
Victor? Berkeley grad here, so
Oh,
go
really?
Bears.
Oh, go. Yeah, go Bears.
But I'd like to ask about, first of all, we're all too familiar with world leaders who want to build garish monuments and spectacles.
Yes, indeed.
But what do you think? I mean, how much of what the Olympics has become was a product of Hitler and that regime, or just the media environment? Wouldn't it have become that anyway?
I think the answer to that is no. Of course, it might have been a big media spectacle, even without Hitler, but you wouldn't have had the propaganda that was displayed there, especially in the opening and closing ceremonies, which were really used to advertise German might and military prowess. You had these huge marches. You had some, fireworks that looked like bombings. No, I think Hitler and the Nazis, not just Hitler himself, but the whole Nazi organization, played an enormous role in shaping the way that those Berlin Olympics looked. Yeah, no, I think that they would have been a big media event, but not the kind of media event that they were.
Okay. Well, among us in the group, we are also readers. So, are there, in addition to the films you mentioned, are there three books in German or English that you would recommend to us?
Yeah, let me just hold up. You like grab a book here in just a second and hold up for you. Sorry for the
Oh,
slight
no
delay. I
problem.
just wanted to hold up a book that I think is really very good. It's called The Games, A Global History of the Olympics, by David Goldblatt, spelled Goldblatt. So David Goldblatt, The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. If you want a huge encyclopedia about the games, you could look to the complete book of the Summer Olympics by David Wallachinsky. That's spelled Wallachinsky. It's encyclopedic. It's not a riveting read because it's basically informative. If you want a good read, I would recommend The Gold in the Rings. The subtitle is The People and Events That Transformed the Olympic Games. And the authors are Stephen Wen, spelled Wenn, and Robert K. Barney, Barney.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I will
Sure.
send everybody links to those books.
Sure.
We have one more question
Sure.
if that's okay.
Yeah, well, of course, of course.
So you said that you would have supported a boycott of the 36 games, but probably not the 80 games.
Right.
Expand on that a little bit more, why
Sure.
you don't think that that was the right decision for the
Yes.
time.
Yes. 36, because I think it really would have hurt. Boycott really would have hurt the regime. And this is a regime that needed to be hurt. Let's put it that way. In 80, the boycott did not do any real damage to Moscow. It didn't, in the first place, there, the boycott was very limited. In fact, the Soviets used it as propaganda. And then, of course, they came back and boycotted 84. So it was a tit for tat business. It didn't do any, it didn't hurt, it didn't undermine the Soviet regime at all. It just bothered, it was a blow to a lot of the athletes who would have loved to have participated and didn't get a chance to do that. It didn't prove any point at all. It certainly didn't change the way the Soviet Union w went about doing things. I mean, the reason for the boycott effectively was, at least officially, was the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan. The Soviets left Afghanistan not because of the boycott, but because they were losing. They were getting badly beaten up, and it was just a real problem for them. And in general, again, I don't think boycotts do very much good.
My first run coach was in the top, was in the varsity eight, ready to go to Moscow, and row in the eights.
Yeah.
And I'm only telling you this because it has an interesting outcome. It wasn't until the last minute that it was decided. So they were actually already over
Right.
in Europe in the
Yeah.
Netherlands training,
Yeah.
waiting for the word, and then the word never came. And but those guys from the 1980 rowing team, since then they have gotten together every year, and
Yeah,
they
well, that's
are
good.
closer and tighter than any other rowing
Well,
national
that's
team
good. That's good to hear.
in the history of U.S. rowing. And
Yeah.
now they're in their 70s, and they and one of them has died, but they're very, very close because of the experience that was. Because of the horribly painful experience.
Yeah.
Because, if you're a rower and you're at your peak, that's it. Four
Yeah,
years later,
exactly. Exactly.
you're not going to be there again. So.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's a blow to the athletes, but it was not really a blow to the Soviet Union. Soviet Union had other problems down the line that killed it, but not the
Exactly.
Olympics issue.
Oh, one more question from Jutta.
Professor, I'm thinking about the most recent Olympics and how Russia is not allowed to compete as a
Right.
country, and yet Russian athletes were allowed to compete as individuals. Do you think that has any, what's your opinion on the effect of that?
Yeah, that's very complicated, and I don't have a really good solid answer. On the one hand, I think something had to be done about Russian doping. It was state-mandated doping, and it was extremely costly for some of those athletes. For a long time, the IOC had just turned the other way, turned its head the other way when it came to these doping scandals. I don't think that all the athletes should be penalized for that. So in some ways, I think it's okay that you have individual athletes being allowed to participate. I would add to that that initially when the games were conceived, the idea before it was set up according to nations was that it would just be individuals that would compete. That was before Coubertin got the idea of making national teams necessary. I think the Olympics would be much better if all the participants did so just on their own, and not as members of national teams. because I think that as soon as you inject this national team into it, you get all this national rivalry, you get the flag waving, you get the animosities, you get much more politics. So in some sense, having those individual Russians just competing more or less for themselves, I think is a better idea than the national organization, oddly enough.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it would be better if everybody participated that way.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, it would be better if the games were indeed about individuals rather than sort of penis measuring events for nations.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well,
All right.
we could spend hours with you, I can tell, but our time has come to an end, and we're very, very grateful that you took this time today.
Good.
And I look forward to, I mean, I'm just delighted to have met you and become acquainted, and we look forward to ongoing
I hope
conversations.
so. Maybe I can come to Minnesota sometime. That would be fun. It looks like a great group.
Well.
Looks like a hell of a lot of fun.
So our theme next year is Die Nachkriegszeit, so the late 40s and early 50s, and all the transformations of that time. And
Yeah, sure.
I can tell you have thoughts about that as
Oh
well.
yeah,
So
oh yeah, 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 indeed. And let's just hope that we, survive the next few years. We're in a very tough time, as everybody knows. So
yes.
events like this are actually very refreshing, because at least for the moment you get a distraction from the shit show that is otherwise descending around our ears. Especially for Minnesota, right? Boy, I think of Minneapolis. Boy.
Well, that's
Anyway.
part of the benefit for us to come to this adult week, because we tend to not look at the news and our phones when we're here, and
Yeah.
it's wonderful.
I bet. We need more of that. Well, good
Yeah,
luck to
and
all of you.
thank
Yeah.
you so much for being
And
with us.
bleib senkrecht. Bleib senkrecht. Yeah. All right. Take care.
Okay, tschüss, danke.
Tschüss. Tschüss. Danke. Tschüss.